depends on how new is new, I guess. yeah, I want to thank the organizers for having me give a talk. I think some of this will be new to some of you. the great thing is that at this place, I don't have to really spend a long time talking about what is an exciton polariton. I always talk about it's a disadvantage. If you do cold atom physics, you don't have to spend the first 10 minutes explaining what an atom is, right? But if you do exciton polariton physics, you have to explain what that is. so just as a real brief review, just to make a couple points, which will not be a hard sell for this group. the system I'm talking about is essentially this one, where you have a two-level or ensemble of two-level oscillators in a cavity. And it doesn't particularly matter that much that in our case we're talking about a solid. So in the typical solid state structure, these are part of the solid, the spacers are solid, and your quantum wells are also embedded in the solid. But really, it's the excitons and the quantum wells, all that matters is that there are good electronic resonance. One way to think about the solid is that it's the maximum density of oscillators that I can put between the two mirrors. I packed all the atoms in. And that matters because the coupling energy goes to square root of n, where n is the number of oscillators. In this case, it's the number of atoms. It's not the number of excitons, it's the number of atoms. And that's obviously the largest when you're in a solid. The trade-off in a solid is you're going to have some level of disorder. And so that will defeat your purposes to some degree. And so we're all familiar, if you were at the conference last week doing anything on exciton polaritons, you know in the cavity you have this in-plane dispersion of the photon, and then the exciton can be viewed as just a constant energy. And then when you turn on the coupling between the two, you get the upper and lower polariton, and the lower polariton has an effective mass that's of the order of 10 to the minus 4 electron masses. So that's what makes it really nice if you're used to working with excitons. You can think of it as an exciton with really, really light mass. If you're used to working with photons, you can think of it as photons that now have mass and repulsive interactions and can thermalize with each other. one important experimental detail is that you can change the detuning of the photon states relative to the exciton states. And so just some terminology here. Over here, you can see the tuning is defined by the photon energy minus the exciton energy. So here, we would say that this is photonic detuning, where this bottom branch now is mostly like a photon. Here we're at resonance, is 50-50, and if we go this way, then it's going to be mostly exciton-like. And that will affect the interactions. It basically means we can tune the interactions. When they're like excitons, they can be strongly interacting, and if they're like photons, they become weakly interacting. And so that's a control parameter we have that we can vary the interactions, which also affects their thermalization. Just a sort of a conceptually way to think about the polaritons. If you think about a cold atom experiment, imagine you could do the following. You could load the atoms in continuously. You have some kind of tunneling barrier that they can leak out of. And then as they leak out, you're able to continuously do some kind of Bragg spectroscopy where you get all their information in terms of their energy and their momentum. That's essentially exactly what goes on with the polaritons. If you think about it as a photon experiment, you're putting photons in with an optical pump. They're going to scatter around and thermalize with each other, and then they're going to leak out through the mirrors. And so it's photons in and photons out, but the trap gives them some ability to thermalize with each other. And that's exactly what's going on here. And so it's really really no different from this kind of system. And then you can say, well, can we control the tunneling out? If that tunneling out is very weak, then we can really have a true equilibrium here. Whereas if this tunneling out is very strong, then we are going to have some kind of non-equilibrium steady state where they really can't thermalize in here before they leak out of the system. And so we can play that game. Now, just a little bit of the history of polaritons. all of the early experiments were done using structures that had a cavity photon lifetime of around a picosecond. From 2000 up to 2010 or 2012, that was sort of the standard for all the polariton experiments. And so it became almost like a byword that polaritons are intrinsically a non-equilibrium system. In some sense, that's maybe of interest to people to say that this is doing non-equilibrium physics, driven dissipative physics that's different from equilibrium. But in the last 5 years or so, those lifetimes have been pushed up a lot. So there's two groups that have lifetimes on the order of 10 picoseconds, and we've got the world record right now of a measured value of 135 picoseconds. Now that's the cavity lifetime, but since the polariton is a superposition of photon and exciton, the polariton lifetime is going to be longer than this. So if it was purely in the photonic side, you would have these as your lifetimes. If you go to the resonance, you're going to have twice this. And if you go more and more excitonic, you can push that lifetime up. So at resonance in our samples, lifetime is around 300 picoseconds. And we can push it longer than that by going more and more excitonic. And basically, you just do this by making the Q of the cavity better. So this Q here corresponds to a Q of about 350,000, which is about as good as you can get in a semiconductor because there's absorption in the semiconductor as well. And if you want to know the technical details about that, I can come back to that. Yeah?
Quick question. I thought most of the physics is at the bottom of this well, which is like K0.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that would be like half photon, half exciton, right?
Right. And that's where we'd have this lifetime around 300 picoseconds. Yeah. So in the early experiments, you're talking literally about lifetime of the ground state of a picosecond. We push that up by more than two orders of magnitude now for the ground state of the system.
So that's the recombination. What's the recombination time in bulk recombination?
Well, the lifetime is really the lifetime that controls things, the lifetime of the photon leaking out through the mirror.
Yeah, but
okay.
What's the...
Now, if you talk about the excitons, but really the primary decay mechanism for the excitons is to turn into photons. So if you look at all the literature of exciton lifetime back in the 90s with just quantum wells, the lifetime of the excitons by themselves, they can't recombine outside of the light cone. So what controls the exciton lifetime is their scattering time into the light cone.
Right.
But the light cone is precisely where the polariton is.
Right.
Okay. So when you talk about an independent exciton lifetime, the only thing that would matter would be a non-radiative term. And that's much, much larger. That's tens of nanoseconds or something. Okay. So we basically can neglect that to all intents and purposes. So really, the lifetime of the polariton is controlled by what fraction of it is a photon, and the exciton contributes essentially nothing to the recombination.
Excuse me, but non-radiative recombination in this case is mediated by photons, or what is it?
For
longer time scale is mediated by photons, or the recombination?
Well, what I can tell you is the experiments that were done on just single quantum wells with no cavity, Ivanov was involved in this and so on. The thing that controlled the lifetime was always the phonon scattering from excited states into the light cone. And so you never could see any other mechanisms. Now, presumably, there is some non-radiative recombination, but these are really good gallium arsenide samples, typically. So essentially, we have not seen any independent channels of recombination other than scattering into the light cone and turning into photons. That's the dominant mechanism for recombination, even if there's no cavity. Even if you're just talking about in a quantum well, standard quantum well. Okay, so let me remind you about some of the data here. when we look at these, we've got a 2D planar thing, and so you've got a polariton moving in the plane, but it can leak out into an external photon. And the Snell's law generalized in this case is that the in-plane momentum has to be conserved. So that means that if I look at the angle distribution of the photons that are emitted, then I get the momentum distribution of the polaritons directly as data. One way to think about it is simply if I'm looking at the light coming out of this, if I do an imaging experiment or a near-field experiment, I get spatial information. And if I do the Fourier transform, I'm going to get the momentum distribution of the particles. Now, you can also reverse this. So you can inject polaritons at a given momentum. So if you come in with an external laser at a given angle, then you're injecting with a fixed energy and momentum, and so you can play around with that. So the best measurement of lifetime that we have actually uses this effect. So here's a kind of a fun experiment here. Typically, these structures have a wedge to them. So the cavity is wider in one side and narrower in the other side. So this corresponds to higher energy, since it's a shorter cavity that gives higher frequency for the photon. So that corresponds to higher energy, and therefore this is uphill. So if I think about here, this is low energy for the polaritons, high energy. And so there's a gradient of energy, and the gradient of energy is a force. So if I send one in this direction, it's feeling a constant force pushing in the opposite direction. These things have an effective mass. So the equations that control this is literally just the same as a bowling ball rolling uphill or a baseball tossed in gravity in the air. Simply a ballistic motion. So if we don't have any scattering that's relevant, then you have conservation of energy. And so you simply have, you know, some initial kinetic energy is going to take it up to some maximum potential energy, then it'll turn around and go back the other way. So we can see this literally in our data. So this is time-resolved data. So this is where we've injected them. And now this is position on the sample, and this is time along this axis. And the red is just literally a parabola for ballistic motion.
Excuse me, David.
Yeah.
This work has been done by Bernard Sermage in 97, you know? Right?
In a waveguide?
In the cavity.
I've seen very...
Jacques Bloch is exactly the same work.
I've never seen anything this long. I've seen short distance motion in a gradient.
They look at log scale, but they see the same thing.
No, I'd be interested in that reference, because all of it I've seen for motion in a gradient was something that went about 5 microns. And this is going about 2 millimeters here. So if you do have a reference, I'd like to see.
No, it's clear it's a longer time scale, but I mean, I think there was a Jacqueline Bloch also in the data.
Yeah,
I can find it.
Yeah, if you can afford it, because like what I said, I've seen people who essentially inject it in one spot and then look at it going downhill maybe 5 microns at most. And this is because of the short lifetime. So this basically becomes for us a measurement of the lifetime, because now we can track their intensity as a function of time and just look at that decay over time and get our lifetime. In this case, it's 180 picoseconds for this particular detuning. Yeah.
So this is probably just a bad choice of color scale.
Yeah.
But it certainly looks like there's a catastrophe at around 400 picoseconds.
Yes, that's a bad choice of color scale because this is the intensity, integrated intensity. It's a single exponential. So it looks like here, basically the yellow coloration drops off and becomes blue.
So the experimental noise, the red dashed line and the blue line in the bottom plot, roughly representative signal to noise.
So this data is extracted from this curve.
The variations, those are roughly signal to noise variations.
Say that
again? The variations of the blue line compared to the dashed line, that's roughly, down, lower.
Here.
Yeah, there we go. That deviation is actually mostly experimental noise, is that correct?
Yeah, that's experimental noise. That's coming from the variations in the street camera sensitivity. Street camera sensitivity is CCD.
So, I mean, I guess I'm kind of curious, if you plot this one in let's call it optician's units, also known as dB.
In what?
In optician's units, so, the dB scale rather than the intensity scale.
Well, this is a log scale here.
Yeah, no, I mean the vertical.
So if we plotted this, I believe this is a linear scale this axis here. Yeah.
And then why does it only start at 1.8?
Why did we what?
Why does the scale only start at 1.8 in millimeters?
Down here? You say, like, why are we starting at this point here? So there's a cutoff here.
I mean, that's fine.
If you go back here, basically, we're injecting them far away, and they're only going to come into view of our lens at some point. Okay.
But what happens to you in 1.7 and 1.8?
I mean, right here.
Yeah. What is the
basically, difference? You can imagine, this is basically the cutoff. Okay, we're only able to image a certain region.
So there's the camera, but then there's all the optics.
So the optics is projecting it onto a CCD, but there's a field of view that is smaller than the size of the CCD camera. Yeah, I can talk about how street cameras work if you want. So it's funny because people talk about slow light, right? This light is so slow it turns around and goes back the other way, right? So it actually stops and goes the other way.
What can be inferred in terms of mobility here?
Well, this data tells you two things. One is it tells you it has a long lifetime. There's it tells you that it's low disorder, right? Because disorder would also scatter you out of. So the effective lifetime that we're seeing here is really the sum of all scattering processes out, including decay. So if it decays and leaks to the mirrors, that gives you a rate of loss. But if they're scattering into other directions, that's another type of loss as well.
But, I mean, it would be visible here, right? If you're scattering.
This is a single spatial dimension. So if you're looking in a two-dimensional picture, you would see scattering going off to the side. And we do indeed see that. We see there is some scattering. But basically, it's a small contribution. So it tells us the intrinsic disorder in the structure is low. And the other thing, because we're operating on the photonic side, it's not purely photonic, but it's more photonic than excitonic. And so that gives you less scattering with other impurities like...
Also, you think the polariton gets more excitonic as it goes along, right?
There's a slight correction for the fact that the detuning can change over this, but actually we picked it so the detuning wasn't changing that much over this particular. But you can see it's obviously got to be changing somewhat because we're firing it uphill, right?
Yeah,
and so the detuning is changing as you go along here, right?
So
basically if you go to a photonic region, then the photonic fraction is not changing that much, okay? Whereas if you get into the resonance region, then you start to have a rapid change of the fraction and so on. Okay. Now, I'm not going to go a whole lot into ways of controlling the potential, but this is one that's used by a bunch of groups. And it just really takes into account the fact that if I pump non-resonantly, which is a typical experiment, so the previous one was a resonant pump. If I pump non-resonantly, then I get both excitons at high K states and polaritons at low K states. The effective mass of these guys is like 10 to the fourth times higher, 10 to the third times higher than the polariton effective mass. And so as seen by the polaritons, they're like heavy bowling balls. They just will sit there and not move. And so that becomes an essentially static barrier as seen by the polaritons. So then you can use that to make potential barriers. And a number of groups now have done this, Jacqueline-Bloch's group, Baumberg's group, and so on. So here's an experiment that we've done with the MIT group where this is the laser focus now. So you have a ring focus of the laser created by an SLM. So basically you have a flat potential in the middle. So this is the cross section of the intensity on this here. And you see basically you have a flat potential with hard outer walls. And so now we can start to do experiments where we have polaritons and essentially no excitons around. And I think that's actually important to realize that that's possible. In the talk we heard yesterday by Sebastian, there's sort of an assumption that you've always got excitons around, and then there's some nonlinear interaction between the excitons turning into polaritons and so on. So that's the case when you have a homogeneous gas sitting on top of a bunch of excitons, but it doesn't need to be the case. So you can have the polaritons now with long enough lifetime and diffusion length to get into a region where there's no excitons around at all. Now, again, just to run through the data collection methods here, we can do regular real space imaging, in which case, again, we can see our sample. We can look at the PL at a single laser spot, just generating that. And then we can spectrally resolve, so we can look at the energy as a function of position along some slice through that. And so this is with spatial imaging sent into a spectrometer to energy resolve. We can also angle resolve by just putting an additional lens. And now we're looking at the Fourier plane. And then that same spot, if we analyze that in momentum space, you can actually see two different behaviors. If we go to an excitonic region, we get good thermalization where they interact with each other. And so now we see that they're filling in this parabolic band. If we go to a photonic region, we can see that we basically just get a Rayleigh scattering ring, and they stay at high momentum state so they don't thermalize down to the bottom of the polariton band. Question?
What do you mean by photonic region and excitonic region?
Again, this is on the sample. You can change the detuning just by picking where on the sample you go. So you can go to a region where the polaritons are mostly photon-like and non-interacting or weakly interacting. What's that?
The low energy polariton.
The lower polaritons, yeah. So the lower polariton changes its character over space. So it goes from highly photon-like to highly exciton-like, and in the resonant region it's half and half. So that basically gives us the ability, just by picking where on the sample we're looking, to change the strength of the interactions. So here, they have very little interactions with each other. They're just scattering off of defects in a Rayleigh scattering type of thing. And this is a very ubiquitous result that's been seen by a lot of groups. And you get basically just a ring in momentum space. But if you make them more excitonic, then they can thermalize and fill in the bottom of the band, and then you get equilibration, and I'll show you some distributions like that in a minute. So let me just remind you, yeah?
Sorry, just so that I'm clear. So these things happen over space because my detuning is changing over space because my cavity is like that, and it's not like I'm changing some detuning.
Yeah, so the detuning is fixed for a certain part of the cavity that will just have a certain detuning.
Okay.
Now, what you can do is you can say, well, the detuning is changing on length scales of millimeters, and I can look in regions of 100 microns, and so I see, I say, a 10% change of detuning over that 100 micron range.
Can I just change the laser detuning?
No, I mean, the laser, you know, we're going to basically, in these, most of these experiments, we're hitting above, very high up in energy. The laser is just creating hot carriers. So there's no resonance in this case. You're just creating a bunch of electrons and holes that are thermalizing down and becoming polaritons. If I was doing a resonant injection experiment, I would have to change my laser wavelength as I went along in order to hit the right frequency.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just remind you. So if you take data like this, okay, let me just focus in on this for a minute. This is now angle resolved, which translates, as I said, to K. So now I can take slices in this vertical direction, and I get the line for a given K, and that will tell me the energy. Okay, so I get the intensity as a function of K. All right. Now I can map K to energy by just looking at this dispersion. Okay. So that means I can also get N of E. So the ideal gas prediction is, you know, just to remind you, is the Bose-Einstein distribution, which tells you the occupation number. And the key thing is that a thermalized Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution on a semi-log plot is just a straight line. That's just an exponential decay where this tail, that slope, gives you KT. When you have a Bose-Einstein distribution, this you start to get peaking up in the ground state. And this is basically this shape gives you a fit for the value of mu over kt. So I can just look at this overall fit here and say, you know, down here I can't get any fit for mu because it's just t coming from this here, all right? But once I go up to higher densities, then the curvature here will give me a fit for the chemical potential. And so then I can use that and extract that. This is probably the most recent data we have on the thermalization. So what you see is sort of a range of behaviors here. Down here, it's not quite thermal. And then as we turn it up, now we're seeing something that fits Maxwell-Boltzmann. And then as we turn it up the density even more, we start to see this upturn. And we get now, as I said, a fit for the chemical potential. Now, there's two ways to look at this. One is completely independent of any fit, all right? It's just that when you get this upturn, okay, that tells you that the quantum effects are important, all right? That tells you that this is going to be true just from dimensional analysis, that the wavelength is comparable to the interparticle spacing. Because that's when, exactly when in this previous plot here, that's what happens when this peak starts to jump up. That corresponds to this condition when the wavelength is comparable to the distance between the particles. And so this is a dimensional analysis argument that doesn't require a specific fit. But now we can do better. We can actually look at these fits, extract the chemical potential, and from that then we get from the fit a value of the total number of particles, right? Because you just get then, you know, total N is equal to the integral right, and in the case of the two-dimensional flat potential, we know what the density of states is, so we can stick that in and get our total number. What's really nice, and I think this is the first time that this has been done, is then independently we can get a measure of the total number of particles without looking at all at the spectra. We can just look at total number of photons. All right. So this is always tricky to do in any kind of spectroscopy thing, but you can say, all right, if I know the efficiency of my system by how many photons are emitted from the source and how many counts on the CCD camera that gives to me, then I can count the total number of photons per second, go back to the total number of particles, total number of photons emitted at the source, and then from the lifetime, which we also measure independently, then I can get the actual number of polaritons in there. And when I compare those two numbers, they actually agree within 10%. Another way of putting that is, this overall scale here is not a free parameter. Okay, so if I change mu, okay, the chemical potential, I'm not just changing the curvature, I'm also changing the absolute position at which these curves occur. Okay, because I'm plotting here absolute N of E. Right? So if you go back here, there's no overall multiplicative parameter that you get to put in as a fudge factor. All right? So when we turn up the curvature to fit this part, it also moves the curve up. And if it wasn't the right Bose-Einstein distribution, then it would overshoot. So, you know, if I fudged, I could have an overall multiplicative factor as a separate number. And then I could fit the curvature, and then if it didn't lie on top of the data and light up here, I could have a fudge factor and just bring it down. But we can't do that here because we have to use the same overall efficiency factor for every curve. So when we change mu, we can't then also change the overall multiplier. So I hope you see this is a highly constrained fit. Each curve is relatively just smooth, but for one fit, I have to fit every one of these curves once they're thermalized, because the absolute value is also determined by the same parameter that gives me the curvature here.
But it's also density of states.
What's that?
Not only the Bose factor, but also density of states.
The density of states is the same for all of them, though, right?
Well, when they condense, then it might be different.
Well, so you might argue that if we go to higher density up here, something funny will happen. But if you just use a constant density of states, and in 2D, actually the density of states is a constant, so it just becomes a multiplicative constant in front. So unless something funny is happening, like you were saying. But for here, basically, I have a overall multiplicative factor which is the same for every curve, and that overall multiplicative factor does not have a lot of range. I can only vary it by 10% or so because I'm measuring that overall multiplicative factor by counting photons directly. Yeah?
Could you recall how you change the chemical potential?
What do you mean by?
You talk about chemical potential.
Yeah.
What is the chemical potential in your experiment?
Yeah, so I guess it isn't plotted here, but yeah, it rains. So once you start to get here, that says that mu is going to be less than kt, right? So you basically have one, the way I think about it is you've got two free parameters. You've got t, and you've got mu normalized by kt, all right? Mu is always negative, it's below the ground state, right? And so these values range from very large when it's classical to, as you turn up the density, you get values of 0.1 to 0.01. All right, so it gets very close. Essentially, another way to think about it is the ground state occupation is just 1 over mu over kt. Right? So once you get into this quantum regime, you've got, you know, one, e to the, well, I'll just put the ground state occupation. Right, but this is equal to approximately 1, right? Those cancel out, and so that basically is just kT over mu, right? So the fit value for mu also has to land you at this point on the axis, because that tells you what the ground state occupation is. So in this case, we're saying a little less than 10 particles in the ground state.
So what is the effect, what's the temperature that is found?
The fit temperature here?
Yeah.
It's about 20 Kelvin. I don't remember for this specific data set. But these are all done at cryogenic in a cryostat, and the polaritons have a temperature which is above the lattice temperature.
Above it.
but which is, you know, so the lattice is probably at 8 Kelvin, and the polaritons are sitting at like 20. So they're, well, they scatter with each other well, but they do not scatter with the lattice well because their phonon emission is very suppressed. To the phonon scattering, just as density of states argument. So this is what's called the polariton bottleneck, that they do not emit phonons efficiently into the lattice. Now, we can turn this off. We can just make them non-thermal, right? So we can...
Is this the first measurement?
What's that?
Is this the first measurement of this? Of the...
Of thermalized polaritons?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we've had it, you know, in various appendices of our papers and so on, but I, you know, I don't think anybody else has claimed to see a truly thermalized gas.
But in 2019, the Nature, yeah,
well,
the
there's an exception. Okay, so Yamamoto did a paper where they had it very excitonic, and they saw it thermalized, but not up to the condensation threshold. So they were able to see basically this, but not the sharp upturn for actual condensation.
But the Nature 2006 has the same picture, no? I mean, the Yacek.
If you look at their actual values, the mu over kT is like of order 1. Okay, so they were not able to get up to the condensation threshold.
Yes, the thermalization was not effective below threshold, but just much below threshold, but above threshold, yes, it was thermalized.
Again, you may be thinking of a different paper than I am. The one I'm thinking of is one where they tuned it to be very excitonic.
No, that's the Nature 2006.
Oh, you're talking about the DeVoe thing.
Yeah, the
no, they were not, you're not able to get a Bose-Einstein fit. This is a dirty little secret, okay? In the DeVoe 2006 paper, you could not fit that data to a Bose-Einstein distribution. You could see that you get a linear thing when you're there, but then when you actually get the peak in the ground state, you cannot fit the entire distribution to a single Bose-Einstein distribution. That has not been done for any of the data up until this point. And so it was what I would say is quasi-thermalized. And so, you know, we actually, and actually I'll talk about that in a minute here. So if you go very far away, so you can detune so they become mostly photon-like. You turn off the interactions, then you get something that's very non-thermal. So these are best fits to Bose-Einstein. You can see they don't work very well at all. This is just by basically making them like photons, okay? but then you can go back to earlier stuff. So this is, again, non-interacting. So this is in the same system. So this is in the long lifetime sample, but with very weak interactions, okay? Now, in earlier experiments, this is data from ours that's very similar to the 2006-2007 data, where you have short lifetime but strong interactions, okay? And you know, if you look at this, you might say, oh, that looks like a Bose-Einstein distribution, but it's not, okay? It's actually a quasi-thermal, it's near like a Bose-Einstein, but it's not actually a Bose-Einstein. Did you have a question?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't want to, this was a bad. Can you go back, just one second. So what they turn around zero energy, they all go down, this case?
Right, it's just not thermalized, they can't.
That's it?
They can't thermalize into those regions. Yeah.
So that's the piece. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. So basically, you know, what you get from these is you can get some kind of effective temperature, but you're not going to be able to fit these distributions to anything because they're basically not well thermalized. Okay. So it's basically you can turn on the strength of the interactions or turn it off to go forward and back.
Well, we are fitting them into
What's that?
I mean, I'm author of this paper, and we're literally fitting them to well. I mean,
you fit them to a equilibrium Bose-Einstein distribution?
Yeah. I mean, you could argue anything, but just, I mean, thermalization was happening just before the transition, so it was below the BC. There was no, in your case, it seemed it's thermalized much earlier, whereas in the other case, it was just before, but all of the
In
the same way, I mean, you can always argue because
well, it also depends on how far out you go in your data. So you can always,
there is this of course issue that as you go to the condenser,
if I go,
you have this different density of state.
Well, let me put it another way. If I go to the short lifetime data here, and I just restricted my energy scale up to here to about, you know, 1 or 1.5 millivolts, I could fit that to an equilibrium Bose-Einstein. But if I extend it, it's not going to fit an equilibrium Bose-Einstein. So part of it is how wide of a range you pick to be able to say that you're seeing thermalization. And in fact, in all the early ones I'm familiar with, and again, maybe you can correct me, but all the ones I'm familiar with, you could fit like this region with the Bose-Einstein, but you couldn't get it to extend with the tail all the way out to have a consistent temperature that would agree with this.
No, the tail was fitting to the one. The, always the problem was that as you go to BDC, you can't really be fitting to Bose-Einstein distribution because you have Bogoliubov modes rather than normal particles.
Well, at least that's the argument. But I actually think there's... Well, so that's one of the arguments is that when you really get BEC, you may break down your density of states and so on. But I also just know from looking, you know, at the data carefully that we get way better thermalization with the long lifetime than we do with the short lifetime.
Below, because in their case, because they rely on density, for lower densities, they couldn't thermalize. And then as you go to higher densities, they could thermalize. So you have many more data below the threshold.
Right, which to me is crucial in saying that this is really a thermodynamic phase transition that's thermalized on both sides of the transition, right? It's not athermal until it becomes a condensate.
Yeah, it was just maybe less yeah. Below.
Yeah, I also would just say, I know both our paper and the DeVoe paper from 2006 were criticized as saying this is not really equilibrium. It's not really a Bose-Einstein distribution. It's really more like, you know, a two-part distribution. So to me, this is, you know, the stuff here is qualitatively better in my mind because it really does have a nice set of curves that fit. And here's the other thing. Again, this absolute number, I don't know whether in the DeVoe paper they could say if we change the chemical potential, we not only got the change of curvature, we also got the absolute values correct. I'm not convinced that that was the case. Because if I only had one curve here, I can guarantee you I could fit it with a Bose-Einstein no matter what, because it's a fairly featureless curve.
Yeah, but if you're about the transition, Bose-Einstein works on quasi-particles, not on particles. So you would have to have completely different spectral weights to fit it. And you're fitting with still the non-condensed spectral weights. So I'm just confused. Because
I agree, but I mean this is not highly condensed here. This is only occupation of less than 10, okay? Again, let me emphasize, if I had only one of these curves, okay, I could almost always fit it with your Bose-Einstein.
So you're always saying that.
Right?
Maybe we continue this.
All right, let me continue on. Yeah.
Can I add a bit of a mess with
another?
That's what KATP is, right? Yeah.
Just my remark is perhaps appreciated by statistical mechanics people. the remark is this, that I learned it from Andrea Gambassi. And basically, he criticized our typical habit of defining thermalization just with the Bose-Einstein law. So what this friend of mine says is that if you want to check if the system is thermalized or not, you not only need to check one-time observables, but you also have to check two-times observables and enforce fluctuation dissipation theorem. So my question is, have you ever thought in these terms? You know my manuscript to your book.
Yeah, yeah.
About how to implement fluctuation dissipation stuff.
Yeah.
And
there's, I guess I'd say there's degrees of what becomes persuasive. And so I would say if I have just one of these curves, that's not too persuasive to me. But it's very persuasive to me that when I change the mu to fit this, I also get bang on relative intensities too. I can't tell you how important it is, but okay, I'm going
to
move on.
To make an extreme example, think you have a piece of charcoal which is heated up at 3000 Kelvin. It emits light with a black body radiation spectrum at 3000 Kelvin. Would you define those photons to be a thermal equilibrium, like a thermal equilibrium gas, or not? In my opinion, this is just because they inherit the temperature from the emitter. So if you take your measurement of the spectrum, it would seem it to be thermalized. Mm-hmm. But if you measure a fluctuation dissipation theorem, does not give you anything meaningful.
Certainly the photons coming out of the cavity are no longer interacting at all, right?
No, but they're keeping a memory. The cavity, if they receive the temperature, from the emitter. So, and they don't have really way of thermalizing. In a sense, I can believe yours are thermalizing.
Okay. Well, let me move on because I have other reasons to believe that they're really thermalized. Okay.
Let's move on.
Yeah. All right. All right. So I will skip this. I mean, basically, this type of early data with short lifetime, we could fit those solid lines are, these solid lines are from a theory of a Boltzmann equation, and I can go into Boltzmann equation, and you get something that's quasi-thermal, but not fully thermal, and the Bose-Einstein factors just come in from these 1 plus n factors here. And I'll skip this. That just tells you that the phonons give you very little contribution. This is old data fitting Boltzmann equation to just bulk exciton motion. But I want to talk about this data here. I talked a little bit about this on Friday. So we also see an energy shift to the blue. And again, we're doing this with no excitons around, just the polaritons in the center of this trap. And as you turn up the density, you see that the line broadens and it also shifts to the blue. And so in a very straightforward mean field theory, you could say that that blue shift should be an indicator of the strength of the interactions between them. And so then you can plot that and extract a number. And this is all the controversy on Friday, is that number turns out to be much, much larger than expected from early theories. But this is something else I just want to point out, the width of that line. So again, if I just go back to this data and take a slice through k equals 0, and then I plot that slice for different powers, you've got the low density data, which has some intrinsic line width. And then as you turn up the power, what you see is you have a broadening. And these guys here at high density fit a Lorentzian. A Lorentzian is a characteristic for collision broadening. And so that's a density-dependent broadening that, again, is an indicator of scattering, that these things really are scattering with each other. So, you know, there's a lot more that can be done on this. We were able to do most of these experiments very far from any exciton cloud. And I won't go into this since I talked about it on Friday. You can do that then as a function of the excitonic fraction. You see that they get more strongly interacting when they're more excitonic. And if you summarize that, you get an excitonic fraction. You get the interaction strength as a function of their excitonic fraction. And basically what it says is we can vary the interaction strength over a wide range from very weakly interacting, turning it off, to turning it up to be much stronger. Now what happens when you condense? The stuff I showed you so far was for in the classical regime just below condensation. In all of these long lifetime samples, you see something very dramatic in the spectral width. As you turn up the pump power, you have a very sharp transition to a spectrally narrow line. That now gives you is indicator spectral narrowing is an indicator of coherence. For sake of time, let me skip a couple things here, move on. Let me just show you some of the stuff that we're doing with ring traps. Now again, this basically just it relies on the fact that we can have our polaritons move out and fill macroscopic things. So this is now the potential we're looking at. So we do this by having a static stress trap where we have an overall global minimum. And then we take a laser and focus it in the middle to make a maximum. So now we have a ring. And then we can look at this. So this is just the stress trap by itself. So you see there's an overall wedge due to the cavity gradient, and then there's also a local minimum from the stress. Then we can turn on the laser. And if you put the laser off to the side, you can see again what I was saying, that you have accumulation of the particles very far from the laser. The laser's sitting here, and these guys are condensing over here. That's like 20 or 30 microns away. And some of them also accumulate in this little nook. There's a local minimum right up here. If we then move the laser over to the center, we get this Mexican hat potential now, where again, we've got a barrier in the center, and then we've got the polaritons accumulating in the bottom. So we can image this a lot of different ways. If I image it XY, I get a nice ring of polaritons sitting in that ring. And then I can look at the thermalization. Here they are. This is where they're sitting on top of the exciton cloud. And I don't know if you can see it. There's this light blue haze, which is basically just KT for the energies of the particles. And then when it condenses, you get a very sharp, again, spectrally limited by our resolution. The condensate is just sitting right there in this ring state. Then we can analyze that with interference. So we can just look at the coherence properties. Yeah.
Just a question. So the laser which you use to pump the jet carriers is the same which you use somehow to defocus the polarizers from the place? Do you get it right?
Yeah. So that's, I mean, so that's one of the disadvantages of this method, is that you have two things it's doing. One is it's creating a barrier, and the other it's shedding polaritons. And so those are not independent of each other. And so if you make the barrier higher, you're also going to generate more polaritons as well. Basically, you can, if you want to, come in with a second laser and say inject them over here with a small fraction. Any barrier that you make always is shedding at least some polaritons.
Right. Okay.
But those polaritons can move very far away from the barrier, because the barrier, the excitons themselves don't move very far, whereas the polaritons have much longer mean free path and fly all over the place. So this is a standard thing to do well as well. You do interferometry, where you just take the image, you send it through two paths of a Michelson, and one of them you flip across one axis. So you're taking an image and interfering it with itself. And so what this shows us now is that basically this side of the ring is coherent with this side, that we're getting fringing from one side of the ring to the other. And so since this is blocked, it basically means the coherence length is this long. So that's an in-plane coherence of 50 or 60 or whatever it is, microns there.
Do you see interference?
What's that?
Do you see current and interference?
I'll get to that, yeah, okay. So that's the next thing we can do. We can actually study this. And so you notice in this one, if you were to count carefully, there's actually one more fringe on the top than there is on the bottom. And if I do it another shot, I have one more fringe on the bottom instead of on the top. So I can extract phase information from that. And basically, just by Fourier transforming, I can get the phase winding around the ring. Okay. And in fact, I do see that I have a phase winding which corresponds to flow around the ring. Okay. So in this case, it's winding this way. In this case, it's winding that way. And some of the times, there's no circulation and there's no net phase change around there. So that, yeah, it's a direct measure of the gradient of the phase, which is the flow around there. Now, one little detail is actually that the phase winding is pi, or it's plus or minus pi, not 2 pi. And that's possible because this is a spinner condensate. So in a spinner condensate, you have alternate solutions for satisfying your boundary conditions. You can have the phase go by pi, and then the polarization also rotate by pi, so that you get a net of 2 pi, and you satisfy your boundary conditions. And that's what's called a half vortex in a lot of the literature, or half quantum flow. And so we can check that by looking at our polarization. So we just put a bunch of polarizers on our image, and measure what's called the Stokes vectors. We end up with a polarization map, and we see that indeed the linear component of the polarization is winding by pi, not by 2 pi as you go around. Okay, so the underlying crystal has a fourfold symmetry, but if you look, say, up here, this polarization here is orthogonal to that, so over here it's wound by pi over 2, and another pi over 2 here. So the linear component has wound by pi, which then allows this half vortex to exist. So you've got the net winding. So this is the theory. This is the experiment. So this, again, is coming from those polarization measurements that we did, as I said. And this is Andrew Daly's theory. And actually, it turns out it's different from a vortex. So in the ring geometry, you have the center chopped out. Okay, so you don't have to satisfy boundary condition of continuity at the center. And so that allows you to have a different geometry in which you can see here the spin, the circular component is given by these circles. Here it's spin up, over here it's spin down. So it's one collective state, the ground state of the trap, but on one side it's got spin up and on the other side it's got spin down. So its linear component is winding, but its spin component is flipping up and down, and it's just basically a precession of the spin as it goes around. Okay, so how am I doing on time?
Well, almost done.
By the standards of yesterday, let me just finish with...
I have actually finished this talk in 45 minutes.
Okay. Let me just really quickly go through something here. I always get this from referees who are unfamiliar with the field. What's the difference from a laser? We've got two mirrors and we've got optical...
You're preaching the choir.
What's that?
You're preaching the choir,
bro. Okay. Well, here's my take on that, okay? In a standard laser, on the block sphere picture, it looks like this. You've got your net polarization going around here. In a condensate, you basically have this picture, where you don't have to have inversion. And this is, of course, Imamoglu's result from the 90s when he was predicting this. You can call it lasing without inversion. And so what that leads to experimentally is if I saturate, if I turn this into a regular laser, I'm saturating this transition here. And of course, that's what allows me to have standard lasing, but it also means that I'm uncoupling these states. So if this is my normal picture, when I turn off the coupling, I go to this, which means I've got an energy shift from the lower polariton up to the bare cavity photon. And so this is data from a few years ago with short lifetime samples, where again, this is energy versus momentum. And here's again that bottom of that parabola. And as we turn up the density, we see, first of all, the blue shift and the broadening, but then we see the spectral narrowing that is associated with the condensation. But then if I keep turning up the power, it broadens, it spoils the condensate, and then at a higher power, I get spectral narrowing again. So now what we've seen is actually two spectral narrowings where we turn the knob in one direction. So I just turn the power up, and I see it gets broad, then narrow a second time. And at this point, it will no longer shift to the blue. It's now going to be pinned to the cavity photon energy. And a number of groups have seen that result as well. It's two-threshold behavior. So I'll just leave these up here. We've seen this. And again, long-distance propagation makes a big difference in terms of being able to move away from the excitons. And we can go between equilibrium and non-equilibrium behavior. And I'll just throw out here, it's a nice place here in California, but Pittsburgh's a nice place too. So if you're ever thinking of going through Pittsburgh, come visit me. We've got all kinds of fun things to do. With that, I'll finish then.
We had many questions. There are more questions, more burning questions.
So maybe just a stupid question from a theorist. So what is the mechanism which allowed you to get to this very long lifetime?
So basically, you want to make the mirrors a lot better so that they reflect better.
Material science?
What's that?
Okay, yeah, please.
Okay, so that's all you want to do, all right, is to make the mirrors better. Okay, well, for these structures, to make them better, you make more layers. So you've got a DBR with your different dielectric constants alternating. And so you're making those layers thicker and thicker, or making more sets of layers. When you do that, you're making the structure overall much thicker. And a lot of MBE people, when you grow a structure that thick, your disorder starts to increase, and it destroys whatever you gain by the reflectivity getting higher. Okay, so you basically have to have a very, very controlled, and so this is a 40-hour growth in the MBE machine, and you have to have an MBE grower who can keep the conditions stable for 40 hours. So we actually do have the excitonic side has a little more disorder than we had in the ones with less reflectivity, but we gain more in lifetime than we sacrifice in the disorder.
Whose fit is better, but actually the point that Giacomo made is a very important one, that basically if we are predicting, let's say, a power law linear correlation, power law means the same as an equilibrium. So if you do N of K, you get, even if you have things which are non-equilibrium, you would get the same behavior of N of K as an equilibrium because we are all predicting the power law linear correlation. So do you think, is there any way of kind of measuring what Giacomo is saying to make sure that things is thing is really thermal.
Well, I think that's a great next thing to do, but frankly, none of the data I've seen so far from short lifetime things has even shown the N of E. All right, so let's start at the beginning. All right, so to be honest, I mean,
but just to have some independent way.
I mean, I looked through a lot of the literature. I did not find anything that was convincingly thermal.
I'm saying that even if you have something which looks completely thermal in N of A, it doesn't mean it has to be.
I agree. So that's the next order experiment to do. But let's start with something that at least looks thermal.
Anyway, there is a way of doing it. It's basically comparing the luminescence spectrum that David has shown with some pump and probe experiment. The condensate is there, and then you shine a small additional beam.
So you get like spectral waves. And
exactly. It's like putting the S of K and A of K in your papers.
Yeah.
I have a question. So in an interacting Bose gas, last question. Interacting Bose gas, so the chemical potential is the interacting case is modified by the density.
By the what?
So mu is equal to Gn.
Right, yeah.
So
basically, it's pushing the ground state energy higher, yeah.
Right. So from the data that we showed in the previous set, is it consistent with this very strong interacting energy, the chemical potential?
Yeah. So, so your first order. So, if you're thinking in sort of a weakly interacting gas type picture, you've got sort of two things to talk about. So, you've got, say, your parabola, and you're saying you're shifting this higher. Okay. So that's basically Gn that you're talking about. Okay. And then I can say I can fit, you know, the thermal occupation of these guys to the Bose-Einstein fit, and basically what you're fitting is, you know, you've got a E minus mu over KT that appears in that, and the E that matters here is the ground state energy, which has already been shifted by this Gn. So when I'm reporting a 0.01 or a 0.1 for the chemical potential, I'm saying relative to the new renormalized ground state energy, whatever that is.
So you shift it, okay.
Okay, let's thank David again.